Radio EcoShock.
Who can keep track of the wild attacks on every aspect of climate science in the United States? For that, we need a real reporter on the beat who is not afraid to speak out. Bob Berwin is a European-based journalist with Inside Climate News. Bob's work is published all over, from Mother Jones and Grist to the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. In December 2024, Radio EcoShock played 13 minutes of Bob covering the harsh rules against climate activism at the COP29 climate conference in Azerbaijan. Now we don't need to travel that far away. The attempted murder of American climate science is happening right at home. From Austria, Bob Berwin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks for having me.
I've read your reporting for years. I've always trusted your byline. But in 30 years of tracking climate news, I never expected this blitzkrieg attack on climate science in America. What are your first impressions so far, Bob?
I think I'm also surprised by the speed and the ferocity of this particular attack this time around. During Trump's first term, it took him a few years to really sort of get traction, and some of the attacks against science kind of went awry, but this time it seems much more focused and much more dangerous for a number of reasons, because it's more organized, because it's part of a sort of an international backlash to science that's been manipulated and amplified by populist politicians, and because it's so cruel, too. I think that has to be said. You know, there's just an element of sadism and cruelty to this that shouldn't not be talked about.
Well, I think another thing that makes it more dangerous is we've just learned that some of Musk's agents have developed a climate agent, an AI specifically for this from XAI. And so what's happening here? I mean, Trump isn't smart enough to track any of this. He doesn't know what's going on. Musk is a pretty busy guy, but once you've got artificial intelligence, we often wondered, well, what happens when AI runs the government? I think we're finding out right now, and that's what makes this even stranger. They reach into every agency and every little person that ever said anything about climate and delete them.
Yeah, we'll have to see how far they go in actually deleting information. You know, I do want to say that regardless of what they do in terms of manipulating websites or altering information, it doesn't change the basic facts of climate science, right? That's written in the books. It's established science. It's well known. The physics are well known. The burning of fossil fuels, the continued and increased burning of fossil fuels is heating the Earth right now on a path to 3 degrees of warming by 2100, which is a level that, you know, a lot of scientists say is going to make it really hard for our civilizations to survive in their current form. The second thing is there are many now international climate data gathering organizations, from Copernicus in Europe to Japanese to Chinese, who have data sets of equal quality and which will continue to be available, at least for the foreseeable future. So it's not like anything that the Trump administration does is going to really actually erase the science. They're only erasing, you know, ones and zeros or pixels or whatever. So
I get you. Well, you know, Canadians lived through a lot of this around 2011 with Prime Minister Stephen Harper. He literally represented the Alberta oil patch. And to get an interview with a Canadian climate scientist, the government demanded I first send questions to the Prime Minister's office. And weeks later, after the story passed, I might or not get a reply, and some wunderkind in the office would even tell the scientist what to say. I wonder if Trump's people took a page from Canadians.
Yeah, I think they probably did. But I also think you can look back at, and in a couple of stories that I've just been working on, I did this. You know, I look back at waves of attacks against scientists, science, and climate scientists in particular. And, you know, there have been earlier U.S. administrations that tried to muzzle climate scientists, too. So I think they, these sort of conservative populist politicians learn from each other. They see, they observe, they watch what works, what they can get away with. They push the boundaries, and several things have come together just in really recently in the last 2 or 3, 4 years that have made this all much worse. Among them, the COVID pandemic, which affected a lot of people pretty traumatically and changed attitudes about science and government, and was used as an accelerant again by certain strains of populist authoritarian leaning politicians to, you know, to pursue this anti-elitist agenda that is a huge part of populism.
Yeah, and maybe we should have expected this in 2017, in the first week of the first Trump administration. The United States EPA came under a media blackout and a temporary freeze on grants and contracts. Bob, why do you think this real estate developer and failed casino operator has such an urgent hate for scientists and climate science?
I have a hard time ascribing hate to somebody that I don't know. And I know less about the EPA in specific, but I have been trying to examine, you know, the roots and causes of these attacks on science. And I'm going to get political again and say that, you know, in general, scientists still enjoy a pretty high level of trust among the public. There was a study in the journal Nature just a few weeks ago that, you know, interviewed 70,000 plus people across 68 countries and found an extraordinary high level of trust in science and scientists, and majority of people saying scientists should be more involved in public policy. And they're trusted much more than almost all politicians are. And so science and scientists with facts, which represent truth, stand in the way of some of these populist authoritarian political projects going on in various countries, including the U.S. And so rather than hate, I think it's a targeted effort to, you know, to remove an obstacle to their political and ideological goals.
Well, and their backers are big oil companies, and they just want to get rid of all the climate activism so they can make more money. I mean, there's money there, and that's a big factor. You know, as of February 19th, the central government website, climate.gov, is still visible. It hasn't been updated for about 5 days. A clever propagandist would slowly change the language there and tone down that site to fool us. Or they could keep it like a honeypot to see who wants climate info. But these guys aren't that bright. I predict they will just wipe the site away with its thousands of links from documents all over the world. Bob, do you think climate.gov will survive as everything else goes dark?
Well, I'm guessing just like you are, it did survive the first Trump administration in mostly unaltered form. I will say that, you know, they may have toned down, you know, certain things here or there. I use that site so much, though, that I didn't notice a huge significant difference. But it's kind of speculation as to what happens, you know, what happens with it now. And, of course, it would be a huge loss. But, again, the science is there. There are data rescue efforts going on right now. There are people who are multiple organizations archiving every NOAA page with data and reports and information. So it may become a bit harder to find, or people won't be able to find it in the place that they've looked for it. And I think that there's a good role there for media to fill, to, you know, to make sure that those alternate sources of that information are well known and widespread, not only among the public, but, you know, even for decision makers who might need them. Like if you know, NOAA's coastal sea level data stuff disappears, it's good for coastal planners to know where they can go to get access to that.
Well, all this is not just happening on the net or in some cyber world. The new administration is freezing or canceling all kinds of funding for anything even remotely sounding like climate change. And that means real scientists, often with years of hard-to-develop expertise, are suddenly out of a job, Research programs built over decades just crashed in a week. We're hearing reports of that. Talk to us about the money and how that translates into people's lives in the real world, in the economy.
Yeah, I mean, it can be devastating, you know, not just scientists, but other federal workers like Forest Service folks and health workers. You know, I know people that made career decisions within the last few years. One scientist, a social scientist who left his university to work with the Department of Energy on just energy transitions in rural Western communities. And he thought he'd found his dream job. He has a young kid. And he thought that's the way he could do the most good, you know, to help with solving climate change. He still has his job right now, but he's in that probationary period, and I doubt he's going to be there much longer. And he expressed to me in an email that it's going to make it really tough for him and his family. And there are just thousands of cases like this, and they're going to continue to pile up of people who, with really without much justification, are just, you know, out on the street. You know, I try to stand back and look at it objectively, but I feel that there's a real meanness there. And that's not out of the question. You know, we've seen that in various political regimes in different countries over the years. Americans have always felt that their country is very exceptional and not prone to the, you know, some of these problems that they've kind of haughtily looked at in other countries. And having lived in multiple countries over the last 20 years, I kind of take a global view of it. And so it's just sad to see. It's sad to see so many people being hurt by a sledgehammer approach to trying to cut the federal government. And it's not just about saving money. You know, there are places to save money where you could save a lot more than by looking at NOAA or NASA or some of these smaller agencies that, you know, have less than 0.5% of the total federal budget. So it's ideological and it's just plain mean.
In 2017, then President Donald Trump announced he would withdraw the United States from the only agreement we have trying to control rising temperatures, the Paris Agreement. And before that withdrawal could take force, President Biden reentered the accord. In your recent article for Inside Climate News, you explored Trump doing it again. What does it mean when the United States, one of the world's largest polluters, becomes one of the few rogue countries with no plan to limit climate change?
It makes it a lot harder for all the other countries that still want to continue to try and pursue the goals of the Paris Climate Agreement. It means all the other countries are going to have to do just that much more to make up for whatever share the U.S. gives up now. It's also worth saying that there is a sort of an alternate effort in the United States consisting of states, of cities, of private industry who have formed a big coalition during the first Trump time. And they've reformed and re-energized. And they claim that whatever the federal government does, they can still deliver a significant percentage of what the U.S. has sort of pledged to do under the Paris Agreement. So that's going to be something, again, for the media to watch closely, whether that coalition lives up to its goals, and to hold them accountable as well, and to, you know, sort of check in every 6 months and say, hey, you said you were going to be able through your coalition to cut emissions by, well, I think it's 45% by 2030. And how are you? You know, are you tracking toward that? What exactly have you done to do that? But I think that's encouraging. And I do think that this happened in the first Trump time and it'll happen again now. It'll encourage cities and other entities, if they want to develop their own sustainable paths. And good for them, because they'll be ahead of the curve once Trump is out of here, hopefully, when he's out of here. I'm looking real hard here to, you know, see more than a completely empty glass, but it is worth, I think it's always worth keeping an eye on that. We're still in coalition is what it's called.
Well, you are finding some positive ideas. Personally, here in the swirl of it all, my hair is kind of on fire. But, I mean, for example, under the new rules, U.S. weather forecasters have to get official clearance to talk to their Canadian counterparts. And the same goes for scientists studying algae on either side of the Great Lakes. My studio's in Canada, so I guess that makes me an international contact. Some flackster in the Trump administration would have to approve my interviews with NOAA and NASA experts, who I've talked to many times in the past. America has been a climate science leader since the 1980s with James Hansen. Now Trump is trying to make all that go dark. Do you think they will succeed?
I hope not. I don't have a crystal ball, so I guess I'll go out on a limb and say I don't think he'll completely succeed. I think that there will be enough resistance, I hope, both institutional and civil, and that this sort of steamroller approach will be slowed. And there will be a lot of severe damage, not only to the science, but to, you know, to the long-term prospects of research in the U.S. Depending on how bad things get, there could be a brain drain where scientists go to other countries. That's what's happening in Europe. There are people actively calling on universities and research institutions to, you know, to make place for American scientists. That's a pretty sad thing for the U.S. because it's been the opposite for decades. You know, scientists from all over the world, if you go to like the NOAA offices in Boulder, it's like a little United Nations. The best scientists from all over the world wanted to come there and work there because they knew that that's kind of the center of where all this stuff was happening. I mean, the ice cores are stored there, you know, from going back tens of thousands of years in the ice sheets. And I don't know. There's just so much institutional science there and so many different ways to share it and alternate networks that I don't think that he can really make science go dark, except in my worst case scenario of really full on authoritarian rule where, you know, where the truth is completely placed with propaganda, like in Orwell's 1984.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Bob Berwin from Inside Climate News. And Bob, I predict more of your stories will contain phrases like a source who prefers not to be named or things like that. How does this attack influence climate journalism covering America?
Good question. I did not have a huge amount of trouble during the first Trump administration reaching NOAA scientists or other scientists. There was a little more jumping through hoops with certain agencies. The Forest Service comes to mind where, yeah, almost every interview had to be pre-approved by a PR flack. I think one of the scariest things about it is, again, is this tendency toward authoritarianism where threats against media have already been made and carried out in the case of the Associated Press being banned because of its use of the term Gulf of Mexico, the accurate description of a certain body of water. And there are news organizations that have been sued. And I think you'll see a lot more of that too. I think they're sort of taking their time perhaps and waiting for a case that they think they can take all the way to the Supreme Court involving not just climate, but, you know, critical coverage of Trump to try and rewrite journalism rules and to get journalism as they see it under control. That's, you know, classic early move in authoritarian playbooks. We saw that in Hungary in very recent times, in Europe here, and in many other countries too. Threat against journalism in general than just climate journalism. I mean, again, there are thousands of alternate sources all over the world, climate scientists. So if you're a German climate scientist and you want to write a story about sea level or ice caps melting, you'll still be able to do that and, you know, and get it published. in America? Will it get a little harder? Probably.
Yeah, well, they're getting lots of help from the billionaire owners of the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times. They're willing to play along with downplaying climate. Meanwhile, though, cities are still burning and flooding more often because climate has been destabilized. The next disasters may hit people harder because the Federal Emergency Management Administration, FEMA, has been slashed, partly to satisfy internet rumor mongers. Hundreds of FEMA staff were just fired with an email and no severance, as far as I've heard. Do you see a coming clash between the reality of disasters and the propaganda, even for Trump voters?
Yeah, I do. Let me go back to just something you said earlier, though. I have issues with the New York Times and the Washington Post, but both those papers have a pretty amazing climate journalists working for them, and they've done a lot of really important climate stories over the years and continuing right now, too. So there's, I think, a bit of nuance there. But in terms of a clash between propaganda and reality, yeah, I mean, I think when there's a disaster that's related to climate, that's when those two things kind of clash. You know, there's the reality of climate impacts, and then there's the propaganda of somebody saying that, no, climate change actually isn't real. And, you know, people very much feel that it's real. And then, as you may be referring to, what we saw in the aftermath of some recent climate disasters were really targeted efforts to create, you know, clouds of misinformation and disinformation that was as thick as the smoke from the fires about who started them. And, you know, you had people and members of Congress talking about, you know, scientists controlling space lasers to start fires, and just incredible amounts of completely wrong information that appears to have really a goal of creating chaos again, which can be a precondition for justifying authoritarian overreach.
Well, how about this news? A February 10th memorandum slashed $600 million from the Department of Energy's climate-related research, including complete defunding of the Advanced Research Projects Agency for the Climate, and this eliminated 22 carbon capture demonstration projects and halted development of next-generation climate simulation supercomputers. And at the same time, on February 1st, at least, the National Park Service staffing changes removed 37 climate adaptation specialists, and they developed wildfire mitigation plans for the western states. For me, Bob, it's like the climate monster is coming. So for Americans, they just leave the door open and wait to get hit. It feels like a death wish, but you don't see it quite so extremely. Am I right?
Well, when you put it that way, it's just silly. You know, it's silly and it's frightening. I mean, I think a death wish is perhaps a pretty morbid thought, but I think I've looked at this whole thing, you know, from a distance in a similar way. It's like, wow, we voted ourselves into this, and now we're letting it happen without really a whole lot of pushback. And maybe people are just tired and ready to give in. In terms of the climate specific things, let's say for, you know, adaptation in the park in national parks, climate adaptation in national parks, I would hope that this concept is pretty deeply ingrained in a lot of these agencies now, and that it'll continue to be part of the thinking as they, you know, as they plan for resources. And the biggest part of that whole problem is that, of course, now we're going in the opposite direction in terms of fossil fuels, and all these various adaptation efforts are, you know, sort of started with the idea that, hey, we're going to meet these Paris goals and global warming is going to level off. And so there's a fight worth fighting here in trying to figure out ways to, you know, keep sequoias from dying in droughts, because if they can withstand the next few decades, the climate will stabilize again. That's that sort of you know, in the framework of the Paris Agreement thinking. So even if you lose for 4 or 5 years, some people who work on, you know, a really specific thing, you can still kind of work toward that goal of climate resiliency. But when you put them all together, like you did in your little intro, yeah, it looks like a death wish. I'll go with that.
You're based in Europe. You report for Inside Climate News about global stories. If American climate science is knocked out for a while, do you think there's enough funding and computing and brain power left to carry on in the rest of the world?
Yes.
I would talk about China in that because I'm just seeing a wave of new papers out of China. They have invested heavily in climate science. They've opened new labs and new institutes to study this, and not all of it's getting properly out into the English world. It's difficult to communicate some of it, but that's one of the big hopes, I think, for climate science. Now, I expect China to take the lead.
That could be. I don't know much about Chinese climate science either. I do occasionally see new studies on atmospheric and ocean sciences, especially, that have Chinese co-authors. There are a couple of significant ones about aerosol emissions from China affecting marine heat waves in the northern Pacific. And I could see China taking the lead. I think that they would perhaps, you know, need to be a little more transparent about their science and participate in the international events maybe a bit more than they do. I mean, they're obviously part of the IPCC, and I wouldn't just look to China, but I would definitely, you know, look to Australia. I would look to Europe especially, which has really invested heavily in doing a lot of the work that NASA and NOAA do as well. And of course, working closely with NASA and NOAA, but also having multiple Earth-sensing missions of all different kinds that help monitor Earth's health.
What kind of stories are you working on now, coming up for Inside Climate News?
Well, the one that's most imminent actually covers some of what we talked about early on, and exploring some of the roots of these recent anti-science sentiments that seem to have been spreading around, and how it's linked with populism, and how it's not really that new, how this goes back. And if you really want to go back, you could go back to Galileo and the Pope. Scientists have always been persecuted for standing in the way of power and ambition at different times in history. You know, in the worst of times, science and scientists have been instrumentalized to do really unspeakable evil. In the case of Nazi Germany, most infamously. And that's something that I'm afraid of too, that if this gets out of control, it's not only that you're blocking scientists or removing their studies from websites, but that all of a sudden you're using them to justify really horrific policies of, who knows, eugenics, racism, all sorts of things. I'm also working on a story specifically about NOAA, sort of looking at how it survived so unscathed during the first Trump administration. And I talked to a couple of pretty high-level scientists there who actually recently retired, which gives them a lot of insight, still fairly recently. And both of them had been there through several political transitions back and forth between Dems and Republicans. And so I'm taking a look at why NOAA did survive, and also trying to answer the question that you asked a few times, what's going to happen this time? But nobody knows.
From Austria, we've been speaking with one of the few independent voices left in climate reporting, Bob Berwin, and Inside Climate News are billionaire free. Be sure to check insideclimatenews.org regularly for the latest. As always, you can also find links to everything we just talked about in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Bob, thank you for your hardworking reporting over the years and spending time with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me. I'm always happy to chat about this.
I'm Alex Smith.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.